Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is September 23rd, and we've got a test a week away from today. So we got two more lectures, but be sure to pay attention on Monday to see if something happens with that scheduled lecture for Thursday, but I think we're going to get it done on Thursday as scheduled. All right, I did send an email out maybe over the, what is today, Thursday? Oh, no, it wasn't over the weekend. Maybe it was on maybe Tuesday night or something, reminding everybody that you're going to have an action potential quiz, an extra credit quiz, and at the end of lab. So you get plenty of time to practice it. If you did not get that email, then maybe you have to check your email address that's in your gateway. Okay, because since this is actually four classes combined, I don't send emails via Blackboard because I'd have to send it four times over. So I use my gateway to send one email to the whole class. So even though maybe you have your email address in Blackboard correct, my gateway doesn't have the correct email address. So you have to look in personal information somewhere. Because I've sent a number of fairly important emails out that way. Okay. So if you missed that email, I think you still can do pretty well on that action potential quiz, and we're going to go over that in today's lecture, and in lab you're going to go over that, and the only thing is then that you do it on the quiz, and that will help you for the test if you can draw that action potential out. All right, so as a basis for understanding an action potential, we need to review just a little bit membrane potential. Unless there's a question before I move on. Yes. Oh, I can't quite hear you. The action potential figure? Yeah, that I included that in the email, and I'll show you when I get to it in lecture. Okay, yeah. If you don't have lab today? If you have lab today, it will be today. Yeah, but Monday, we'll do it on Monday. So what's important is that you actually take that quiz before the test. It won't help you very much if you take it after the test, right? Because what it really prepares you for is to do well on the test, and it's more important to do well on the lecture tests and quizzes. Okay, so it will help you get ready for the test. All right, so I got to pass the sign-in sheet around too. Okay, so membrane potential we've talked about already. And you should know what ions are at a high concentration outside the cell, what ions are at a high concentration inside the cell. And there are some big anions inside the cell that help the diffusion gradient because of the electrochemical gradient of potassium to enter the cell. All right, and you also know how to use an Nernst equation to figure out that there is a membrane potential. And when we say potential, that's just a voltage. All right, so there is a gradient of charge across the cell membrane. And what can cells do with a gradient? What is it really? It's an energy supply, right? It can be used to power certain things inside the cell. All right, so a cell at rest has a negative internal charge compared to the outside due to unequal distribution of ions, right? And also the sodium potassium pump helps maintain that resting membrane potential. And one thing that we don't deal with a lot in this class, it's a different kind of equation compared to the Nernst equation, but even if the cell membrane changes permeability to an ion, that's going to change the potential across the membrane. All right, so potassium has a very high permeability for the membrane because there are some channels that are open pretty much all the time. We call those leak channels. Potassium can move across the membrane. They're attracted to the inside of the cell because of all those negative ions that are basically proteins and nucleic acids. And those can't leave the cell. So there is a resting membrane potential. And because there is that gradient in charge, cells are excitable. They can discharge that resting membrane potential very quickly by adjusting the permeability to other ions inside the cell. So by adjusting sodium channels, by opening sodium channels, for instance. All right, so neurons and muscles do this to generate electrical impulses. So that's kind of what we're going to look at today. So here we have a nice neuron, right? Cell body, some dendrites here, and an axon. And we've got a special little apparatus where we can put one electrode inside the cell, and we put another electrode outside the cell. and hook that up to a voltmeter or a fancy kind of voltmeter that actually displays the voltage, not as a number, but as a graph right here. We would call that an oscilloscope. All right, so these two electrodes are going to be able to measure the electrical potential across the membrane. And at a cell at rest, that potential is what we call RMP, resting membrane potential. And for a typical cell, we see that it's at about, what, minus 70 millivolts for every particular cell. So this dotted line right here just represents pretty much a typical resting membrane potential on a typical cell. All right, but it can change depending on what the cell is doing and if the cell is receiving inhibitory or stimulating input, and that membrane potential can move up above, right, in this diagram, above resting membrane potential, right, or it can move down below the resting membrane potential, and I want you to know how we talk about those two different events. As it moves above, notice, which way is it going? Is it getting farther away from zero or approaching zero? Is it getting closer to zero voltage or more? Is it getting more negative or less negative? It's less negative, right? So we call that when the membrane potential becomes less negative, when it approaches zero, we call that depolarization, okay? And that's because it's getting closer to zero. Now, if the resting membrane potential moves farther away from zero, that means that it is becoming more negative. We call that hyperpolarization versus depolarization. And it just so happens that depolarization is a stimulatory, it's an excitatory event, while hyperpolarization is an inhibition. It will inhibit the cell from generating an action potential. All right, so don't forget, this is the number that you want to kind of focus your attention on. That's 0 volts right there. So this is a nice fancy apparatus that you can measure voltage with. All right, so now we want to look at some proteins that are embedded in the membrane. So remember, the best way to think of a cell membrane is with the fluid mosaic model, not just the phospholipid bilayer, but a fluid mosaic model. And the cell can insert various kinds of proteins in the membrane to control its own physiology. All right, so the membrane potential changes occur by ion flows through the membrane due to channels. Some channels are normally open. We would maybe call that a leak channel, for instance, for potassium. And some are closed all the time, but maybe they can be opened up at certain kinds of events. All right, so those that are open, like for potassium, we call those leak channels. Closed channels have molecular gates that can be opened. They can change the state of that particular channel. And we're going to see that there are two important kinds of channels. There are voltage-gated channels. Right, they are opened by depolarization. So these particular kinds of proteins have electrical charges on them. They're inserted into the membrane, and when the electrical charge across the membrane changes, that causes a conformation change of these proteins, because remember, negative charges are attracted to positive charges, and these can act as little motors, motivating forces that can change a conformation in that membrane protein. All right, so voltage-gated channels, or the voltage-gated potassium channels, are closed in resting cells, even though the leak channels might be open, but these voltage-gated channels are closed, and sodium channels are closed in resting cells too. Now, these voltage-gated channels can open or close depending on the voltage across the membrane, right? And that would be due to a depolarizing stimulus. We'll change those channels. All right, so here we have a graphic of a nice phospholipid bilayer with a channel inserted into it. And in the resting membrane, what can you tell me about the patency of this particular channel or the openness? Is it open or is it closed? Yeah, it's kind of puckered together right there, so it's closed, so no ions can move across this particular channel. But if the cell depolarizes across this membrane right here, right, if the voltage starts to disappear, that's going to influence the conformation of this protein, and we're going to see that it actually opens up. So now it is patent, right? So that happens to some kind of excitatory event that will produce depolarization across the membrane. All right, so what ion is at a high concentration outside?
Sodium.
And what's the charge on sodium? It's positive. Borage says, yeah, it's a nice positive ion. And what's the charge on the inside of the cell? It's negative. So that sodium is going to experience a force drawing it into the cell for two reasons. One is that the concentration gradient, right, is going to force it inside the cell, but the electrical gradient is going to force it inside the cell as well. So for two reasons, there's going to be a big rush of sodium entering the cell right here. And then, as a matter of fact, there's so much sodium going to enter the cell, right, that's going to cause it to depolarize and actually become even more positive than zero. It will actually, now the charge across the cell is going to reverse, and now there's going to be, instead of a more negative on the inside, it will even be more positive on the inside because sodium is running in. And when so much sodium runs in that the charge reverses itself, there is this other little thing right here that we call an inactivation gate, which then can plug up this channel. Even though the channel is still open, once it gets plugged up, sodium can't rush into the cell anymore. So we have channels that can open or close depending on the voltage across the membrane. Furthermore, we have this inactivation gate that can basically stop the motion of sodium inside the cell. So we want, and we're going to relate this to an action potential. All right, so action potentials mean that we're looking at the voltage across the cell membrane, right? This voltage across the cell membrane, but it's not a resting membrane potential, which is stationary. An action potential means what? Something's in action, something is changing. So the voltage is changing across the cell membrane. And this is going to be due, it's going to be due to voltage-gated channels, right? So I want you to relate action potentials to voltage-gated channels. We're going to look at some other channels in just a little bit. All right, so this right here is the figure that I want you to become familiar with way before the test, right? This is the one I want you to be able even to draw from memory. So here we have a plot of membrane potential. So we got two electrodes across the membrane, one inside the cell, one outside the cell, and it can measure the difference in charge across the cell membrane versus time, and this is in milliseconds, so it's pretty fast. This is a pretty fast signal. So right here at minus 70 millivolts, what do we call this? Resting membrane potential, and you could just call it RMP if you want to, and I'm going to speak about it in terms of RMP all the time, but you should know that's a resting membrane potential. And then we see that the cell changes the potential, or for some reason the cell changes the potential across the membrane, and okay, it moves to, say, like minus 55. All right, so it becomes less negative. What do we call that when something becomes less negative, or when RMP becomes less negative? Is it hyperpolarizing or depolarizing? Depolarizing, because it's getting close to zero, right? The difference of the potential is disappearing. All right, and when it reaches this dotted line right here, something special happens. We call this the threshold voltage. All right, right at this particular point, this is when the voltage-gated channels will change their state from, or their conformation from closed to open. So right here, the voltage-gated channels for sodium will open up, and these open up very fast. All right, so now what happens? Sodium has a way to move across the cell membrane, right? And which way is sodium going to move? Where is it high? Outside. And where is it negative? Inside. So for both those reasons, sodium is going to rush inside the cell, and when it rushes in, what happens to the electrical charges inside the cell? They become neutralized because these positive charges come in. They neutralize negative charges. And there's so much sodium entering the cell that the cell membrane changes its polarity. It actually becomes positive on the inside of the cell. So this is what I want you to realize is the first part of an action potential. And this first part of an action potential is what we call depolarization. And it is due to what ion? Sodium, and what is that ion doing? It is entering the cell. It's rushing inside the cell, and this is a purely passive process. It's rushing in because of the concentration gradient and because of the potential difference across the membrane. Okay, so number one is depolarization due to sodium rushing in, but you should have a feel for why it is rushing in because of the concentration and the voltage. All right, right at this period in time right here, when it when the cell membrane now reverses polarity and it's at about 30 millivolts, something funny happens to those sodium channels. They slam closed because of the inactivation gate. The inactivation gate plugs up the channel, and then immediately what happens to the flow of sodium inside the cell? It gets stopped. It's plugged up. Okay? Now, there are other channels, too, that start to open up right at the same time, right when the membrane potential reaches threshold. Those are potassium channels. But the potassium channels are a little bit slower to become activated. It takes them a little bit longer to change state from being closed to being open. All right, so I'm passing around the sign-in sheet. Please assign the sign-in sheet. So the first gates, the first channels that open up are the sodium, and the second ones are the potassium. And so now they are starting to open up more and more and more. And where is potassium at a high concentration? Inside the cell. Okay, and now, but what's the voltage inside the cell? It's positive. Okay, so now potassium really doesn't want to stay inside the cell because inside of the cell is positive. And the concentration gradient is what? High on the inside, low on the outside. So potassium would like to do what? Diffuse out through those channels, and indeed it does. And as it takes that positive charge outside the cell, what happens to the membrane potential across the membrane? It starts to become more negative because potassium is taking positive charge outside the cell, and we see this now repolarization back to resting membrane potential. Okay, so the second part of an action potential is repolarization. So you got depolarization due to sodium. Repolarization is due to potassium now leaving the cell. So you have a sodium current and you got a potassium current that produces this action potential. And so much potassium leaves the cell that it produces this little overshoot beyond the resting membrane potential. And we're going to see what that's called. That's called hyperpolarization. Right? And remember, as the cell becomes hyperpolarized, that's an inhibiting event on the cell. That actually inhibits the cell. So that's an action potential kind of in a nutshell, but you just have to remember that the voltage across the membrane can cause proteins to undergo conformation changes because these proteins have little charges on them, right? And so when the voltage changes, they get pushed and pulled in a little bit different way. All right, so how do we start an action potential? There's got to be some kind of stimulus, which is hyperpolarizing or depolarizing? A stimulus is depolarizing. That means that it's going to move it RMP up to zero. Okay, and then when it reaches threshold, a whole bunch of sodium voltage-gated channels open up. Okay, so when there's a depolarizing stimulus, the voltage-gated sodium channels open up. Okay, sodium diffuses into the cell, which does what? Depolarizes the cell more, which then triggers more sodium voltage-gated channels to open up. So more sodium enters the cell, right? And the cell depolarizes some more. That opens even additional voltage-gated sodium channels, which then allows more sodium to enter the cell. So what kind of feedback mechanism does that sound like? That's a positive feedback mechanism. So that was one of the things that I wanted you to memorize way back in chapter one, that this phase of an action potential is actually positive feedback. All right, and then how come all the sodium in the world isn't inside of a cell? What stops this positive feedback mechanism? Something kind of drastic, and that is let's go back to here. This inactivation gate just plugs up the channel, and that then stops that positive feedback mechanism, okay, and stops the sodium current. All right, right at the same time of that depolarizing stimulus, the voltage-regulated potassium gates start to open, but these are slow, right? So these are slow, but when they start to open up, because of the reversal in the membrane potential, potassium diffuses out of the cell, and then the membrane potential becomes less depolarized, it repolarizes, and then brings it back down to resting membrane potential. Okay, so I think you should have a pretty good feel for an action potential and why it happens. It's because of the voltage-gated channels, and just the difference in concentration and charge across the membrane is going to determine which way these cations move, producing this action potential right here. Okay, and you should also realize that an action potential starts when the stimulus reaches threshold, and then it returns to resting membrane potential. Okay, who's got a question about this right here? So just remember that opposite charges attract each other, and the concentration gradient will make ions move as well. Okay, so I think I talked about all this, the positive feedback loop already, the mechanism of the action potential. All right, repolarization. Repolarization takes place when the sodium voltage-gated channels close, while the voltage-gated potassium channels are still open. The voltage-gated sodium channels close right at this point here, when the inactivation gate closes. All right, and when potassium is driven out of the cell, that brings the membrane potential back down to RMP. All right, so both depolarization and repolarization occur by diffusion. All right, so it's not an active process. It's set up by the sodium-potassium pump, but that happens even when the cell is at rest. So the cell is charged up, ready to institute an action potential. All right, and then after an action potential, the sodium-potassium pump readjusts the concentrations of sodium and potassium across the membrane back to where they were before an action potential. But the action potential itself is a passive event. So when you think of an action potential, you should break it down basically into two kinds of processes. One is a sodium current and one is a potassium current. So here we just have our typical kind of action potential, but let's look at the diffusion of sodium and potassium. All right, and we're going to justify it in time. So we're going to look at the permeabilities of sodium and potassium. This first graph right here is sodium. The second one right here is potassium. So the initial event of an action potential is due to what ion? Change in permeability of sodium, right? The permeability of sodium changes drastically because of that positive feedback mechanism. And then right at the peak right here, that inactivation gate closes. So the permeability of sodium rapidly decreases as a result of that. All right? But you also have the potassium voltage-gated channels. They're a little bit slower. Right? They start to open up at the exact same time as the sodium voltage-gated channels, right when the stimulus voltage reaches what point? It reaches right here. This is threshold. Let's go back a slide. Right? When the depolarizing stimulus reaches threshold, that's when both the sodium and potassium voltage-gated channels open. But remember, the potassium channels are slower to operate, and as a result, repolarization happens after depolarization. And once it reaches RMP again, then both the gated sodium and potassium channels are closed, and only those potassium leak channels are open. And the cell is nice and restful right at RMP. Okay, so action potentials, if we were to look at a series of them, okay, so here we have resting membrane potential, typically minus 70 millivolts, and if we come by and stimulate the cell with a very weak stimulus, right, we see that at this point in time, there is no action potential forming. So what does that mean in terms of that graph that you have to draw? It was a stimulus, so it was depolarizing, but it did not reach what? Didn't reach threshold. We call that a sub-threshold stimulus. In that particular case, the neuron is really not so interested with that kind of stimulus. It actually ignores it. So if we look at this graph right here, we see what? Absolutely no blip in this line. There's certainly no action potential. All right, it just completely ignores that depolarizing stimulus. All right, so the strength of the stimulus is indicated by the length of this arrow right here. So at another time, what do we do to the stimulus? We increase the stimulus, right, because this arrow now is a little bit longer, and look what happens. We get an action potential. So what does that tell us about this stimulus right here? It has met threshold, so it is a threshold stimulus. All right, and that produces an action potential. All right, and then we let that cell recover, and then we come along at another time and issue another stimulus to that cell. And what is this stimulus like compared to the second one? It's increased, right? It's even a higher stimulus, right? And, but now what can you tell me about the second action potential compared to the first one right here? They're exactly the same. And let's kind of continue with this. We come along now with this fourth stimulus, and it is above threshold. It's a threshold stimulus, and it's even stronger than this third one right here. But what about the action potential? It's exactly the same. So the strength of a stimulus produces the same action potential. Another way of saying that is that every action potential that a neuron produces is exactly the same as the one before it. It is independent of the stimulus strength. All right, so that's kind of a strange kind of concept. Okay, so all action potentials are exactly the same. Let me just take a peek at the next slide right here. Okay, this is good. So all action potentials have the same duration and have the same amplitude. And when I say amplitude, I mean the peak, right? The height of the action potential is the same, or the degree of depolarization is exactly the same, irregardless of what the strength of the stimulus is. Another thing about action potentials, they're going to move down an axon, which is very long, right? It could be a meter long. The action potential at the beginning of the axon is exactly the same duration and height as the action potential at the end of an axon. So we say that action potentials propagate, they move along an axon without decrement. They don't fade away. And that's kind of amazing. That's an amazing thing that biology has figured out how to do. All right, so there is no decrease in signal. That's because voltage-gated channels are found on the plasma membrane only of axons, not on dendrites or the cell body. And that's why we say axons are the sending part of a neuron, because they have voltage-gated channels. All right, we're going to look at another kind of channel, and those are what we call ligand-gated channels. Ligand-gated channels are found on dendrites and cell body, and that's the reason why that's the receiving end of a neuron. I'll say that a couple more times in a number of different ways. The other thing about action potentials is that they're always going to be separated in time from each other, right? They can't come at the same time, so that means one cannot be superimposed on the other. And because of that, they can't summate, right? They can't add to each other. Like, you can't have another action potential, you can't have two action potentials so close in time that they actually add to each other and produce a higher depolarization. They always have a constant amplitude. And the reason why action potentials will always be separated from each other is because, oh, this is a good place to look at it, because right after an action potential, look, there's this area of hyperpolarization that is always produced. And what is hyperpolarization? Does it inhibit the cell or does it excite the cell? Yeah, because it drives it further away from threshold that inhibits the cell. And because of this refractory period right here, action potentials cannot come close together to each other. They're always going to be separated from each other, and therefore they can't add up, because you can't have two at the same time or even almost at the same time because of that refractory period, that area after the action potential that is hyperpolarizing. All right, so we say that action potentials have an all or none response. They have the same duration, same amplitude, and you either see them or you don't if the stimulus doesn't reach threshold. All right, so do you believe the nervous system can work that way? Can you tell a difference in stimulus intensity in your everyday life? Okay. Yeah, you can, but not because of these action potentials, right? Because they have the same amplitude and the same duration. So, for instance, I could say something really softly, right, which is low intensity. Or I could say something really loud. So you can definitely tell. Your brain can tell the difference in intensity. So you should wonder why that is. It's not due to the amplitude of an action potential or its duration. It's due to something else. Okay, and that's what this next slide is going to show us, right? And you can tell when a light is really dim or when a light is really bright, right? Or somebody is just kind of brushing up against your arm, or somebody's really grabbing your arm hard. Those are differences in stimulus intensity. All right, so how is stimulus intensity coded? This word right here is coded. All right, it's All right, so it's coded by action potentials. As increased stimulus intensity, or as stimulus intensity is increasing, that causes more action potentials to be created in a certain period of time. So the frequency of action potentials changes as the intensity goes up. We call that a direct relationship, right? As the stimulus intensity decreases, the frequency of action potentials decreases. All right, so here we have a cell, and we're measuring the membrane potential across the cell. All right, and it's at RMP. Let's turn on a stimulus and keep it on for a certain period of time, then turn it off, make it go away. All right, but notice this stimulus, what does it produce any action potentials? All right, so this is what? The strength of the stimulus versus time. That's what we want to look at. So this stimulus, even though it's on for a long time, this whole period of time, is what kind of stimulus? It is sub-threshold, right? It hasn't depolarized the membrane up to threshold. It probably depolarizes the membrane to some degree, but not up to threshold. And if it doesn't reach threshold, then an action potential doesn't start. Okay. All right, so now we turn it off and wait for a little period of time. Now we turn the stimulus on, but what about the intensity or the strength of the stimulus compared to the first one? It is greater, right? It is increased, and now it has reached threshold, and what does it do? It causes an action potential, all right? And so we see four action potentials right here in this same block of time that this first stimulus was left on for. And what can you tell me about the intensity of the first action potential compared to the second, compared to the third, compared to the fourth? Exactly the same. And what about the duration? It's kind of hard to see because it's kind of shrunken down in time, but the duration is exactly the same. But there's a big space between these action potentials, which means that the frequency is relatively low, right? It's a relatively low frequency of action potentials. All right, let's do another stimulating event at another time. We keep the stimulus on for the exact same period of time, but now the stimulus intensity is even higher than the second one. And what can you tell me about these action potentials? What about the amplitude compared to this first set over here? Exactly the same. What about the duration? Exactly the same. But during that period of time, what has changed? The number of action potentials or the frequency of action potentials going to the brain has changed. And now the brain can tell definitely there's a difference between blip, 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 and something that has a much higher intensity, which is what? Blip, 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 blip. Okay, so your brain can definitely tell changes of intensity. And this is the language that your brain uses to communicate, which is strange. It communicates in terms of blips, right? And you can actually listen to how your brain thinks if you put electrodes into neurons and listen to these little blips. All right, so this is what we call frequency coding. So stimulus intensity, all right, is given to the brain in terms of frequency coding. It's the frequency of action potentials, not the amplitude and not the duration. Okay, so that's pretty interesting. This kind of looks like a little computer digital circuit that's working. All right, it's not purely an analog signal. So how does that happen? Well, it's due to something called that relative refractory period right here. So here's that action potential, right? So here's RMP, here's a stimulating depolarization, and when it reaches threshold, here at minus 55 millivolts, what happens right at this point? The voltage-gated sodium channels open up as well as the potassium, but remember the sodium are the fastest ones to open. Sodium rushes inside the cell. And right at this point right here, that inactivation gate closes. So at this point in time, the neuron cannot be stimulated again to cause an action potential, right, even though it's a super threshold stimulus, because that inactivation gate is operating, it closes that channel. So this is what we call an absolute refractory period. A neuron cannot be stimulated no matter what, and that's due to what? That little ball and chain, if you can remember, that plugs up the sodium channel. It can no longer depolarize. All right, so then it starts to repolarize. And right at this point in time, all right, the potassium channels are still open. Potassium is still leaving the cell. And so much leaves the cell that it becomes hyperpolarized right here. Okay, and this is what we call a relative refractory period. At this point in time, the cell can be stimulated with a depolarizing stimulus, but what does that stimulus have to be? What was it this first time? What was the magnitude of a stimulating depolarization? What is 70 minus 55? Okay, what is that? 15? Okay, 15 millivolts. So in this particular case, when the cell was at rest, it only took a 15 millivolt stimulus to produce an action potential. But now when you're in a relative refractory period, let's just say this is minus 75 millivolts over here, what does the stimulating depolarization have to be to reach threshold? It has to be 20 millivolts. So a greater stimulating intensity has to be produced during this relative refractory period to overcome this area of hyperpolarization. Okay, so that is why this right here, this second stimulus, right, it is threshold initially, but because of this big area of relative refractory period, it's not strong enough to overcome the relative refractory period, so it takes longer for this cell to produce another action potential. But this stimulus, the third stimulus, now can overcome that relative refractory period because it has a higher intensity, and so action potentials come at a quicker rate or a higher frequency. All right, that's due to the relative refractory period that we see right here, this area of hyperpolarization. All right, and this is due to what kind of channels? The two kinds of channels that I want you to be aware of are, number one, voltage-gated channels. All right, hopefully you can see that. Voltage-gated channels. Looks pretty good. And the second kind that we really haven't talked about yet are what we call ligand-gated channels. Okay, so let's go back to voltage-gated channels, and where do we find them? We find these in along the membrane of axons. And so axons can propagate action potentials. It can take a signal at the axon hillock and transmit it all the way down to the axon terminus by the synaptic boutons. And remember, how does that action potential move? It moves without decrement. It doesn't change. It's at the same amplitude at the beginning, at the proximal end of the axon, compared to the distal end of the axon. Right? It has the same duration, the same amplitude. Ligand-gated channels we find on dendrites and the cell body. Okay, voltage-gated channels make axons the sending part. I'm in a node there. I'm out of the node, okay? The sending part of a neuron. Sending part. Okay. And these ligand-gated channels make the dendrite and cell body the receiving part. They're going to receive signals from other cells. Receiving. The receiving part of a neuron. All right, so we're not talking neuroglia. We're talking neurons because neurons do what? They send action potentials. And an action potential in motion down an axon is what we call a nerve impulse. So a nerve impulse is based on action potentials. Okay, let's see what our next slide is right here. Axonal conduction. Okay. The most efficient way for an axon to send a signal is with an action potential, but electrical currents can even travel down an axon, and it has nothing to do with voltage-gated channels. And if we look at this graph right here, which is a plot of a membrane potential versus time, and if we have a membrane that doesn't have voltage-gated channels in it, all right, so this right here is what, depolarization and repolarization, but this is just due to some kind of stimulus. Maybe we just inject some positive ions into this axon right here, and we watch and see what happens to that current as it moves down an axon, right? And this is not due to voltage-gated channels, let's just say there are no channels in this membrane at all, but this electrical current is going to flow because there's plenty of charge inside the cell. And as that current flows down an axon, look what happens to it. What's happening to it? It is decreasing. It's dying away. So sometimes we call these kinds of things graded potentials as opposed to action potentials. They're graded potentials because the intensity of that potential decreases over distance and over time. So it's graded. It changes. And that is due to resistance inside the cell, and it can be due to leakage of current across the cell membrane. And that resistance changes as the diameter of the axon changes. As you have, well, I tell you what, think maybe of a garden hose, all right, versus a straw. Or maybe you guys have different kinds of garden hoses. What kind of hose can transfer water very easily? One with a really small diameter or one with a big diameter? The big diameter can transfer a lot more water because the resistance goes way down as the diameter increases. The same thing for wires, right? If you have a wire with a large diameter, it can carry a lot more electricity, a lot more current compared to a wire that is really, really thin. The same thing for neurons, right? As the diameter of an axon increases, the amount of current that can flow through it increases. And as the axon gets smaller in diameter, the resistance increases and the signal dies away more quickly. So fast neurons, right, have a large diameter associated with them. Okay, so this slide right here shows a neuron. Here's the cell body. Here's the axon hillock. Right, after this axon, this is where the cell starts to place voltage-gated channels. There are none on the cell body and dendrites. Right. This part of the cell right here only receives stimulating events due to ligand-gated channels, and that electricity then flows through the dendrite over the cell body, and that's what a graded potential is. But what can you tell me about a graded potential? What's the intensity of the stimulus on the tip of this dendrite compared to over here on the cell body? What happens to it? It actually, I want to go back. It does what? It starts to die away. Okay, so graded potentials, we say, propagate with decrement. They actually start to fade away. But action potentials propagate without decrement, right? The intensity of an action potential is the same over here as it is over here. Right, that's an action potential, but graded potentials actually die away. All right, so an action potential can be initiated by a graded potential that's received on this dendrite if, even though it's dying away, if it is still at threshold by the time it reaches the axon hillock. Right, that's all that matters. Okay, and once it reaches threshold, okay, let's see what happens on this axon right here. Okay, so you have an area where there is depolarization because there's an action potential that starts right here. What is the first phase of an action potential again? Is this sodium entering the cell, which depolarizes this region of the cell. And when this region over here depolarizes, remember that's a big, powerful depolarizing event, what happens to the voltage-gated channels that are neighboring this region right here? They start to depolarize, and when they reach threshold, what happens? An action potential starts right here. And then when this neighboring region feels the depolarization from this one right here and it reaches threshold, what happens? An action potential starts over here. All right, so an action potential is going to move from left to right down the axon. And this particular axon does not have any support cells on it. I don't see any Schwann cells on it. It does not have a myelin sheath. And in that particular case, right, an action potential has to be developed on every single part of the cell membrane. Okay? It goes continuously from one end to the other. And that kind of conduction speed is slow. We call that continuous conduction. when that happens, when every single piece of the membrane has to depolarize or conduct an extra potential, right, it's relatively slow on an unmyelinated axon. Okay, now if an axon is myelinated, let's take a look and see what happens. So what kind of cells are these? Let's say that this is the peripheral nervous system. What kind of cells are these support cells right here? Yeah, they're neuroglia, but there's a specific name. And I hear, and you're right, it's a Schwann cell, right? So these are Schwann cells in the peripheral nervous system, but what would you call them in the central nervous system? Those are oligodendrocytes, right? But they produce the same kind of chemical compound, namely myelin. All right, and that myelin in this area right here prevents the leakage of currents outside the cell, and that decreases the resistance in this axon. But also underneath the Schwann cell, there are no voltage-gated channels in this region right here. We only have voltage-gated channels in these spaces between the Schwann cells that we call nodes of Ranvier, nodes of Ranvier. These are the only places where we have those voltage-gated channels if it's a myelinated axon. Okay, so let's just say that this is the axon hillock right here. It depolarizes, it starts an action potential, and a current then will move down the axon, and it's going to move with decrement across this space right here. But remember, what's the distance of a cell? It's tiny, right? It's a tiny, tiny distance. This distance of this Schwann cell is really small. So it doesn't decrease so much that it's below threshold by the time it reaches this node of Ranvier. Okay, so that little graded potential meets threshold right over here, and we have voltage-gated channels. So what happens when these voltage-gated channels receive a threshold stimulus? That fires an action potential, which then produces some electricity that moves through the axon very rapidly, right? Which then depolarizes this next node of Ranvier, which then sends electricity underneath this Schwann cell, which then reaches threshold at this next node of Ranvier. So you have an action potential here and here and here and here. And that just means that the propagation of that action potential through a myelinated fiber is much faster because it doesn't move continuously down the membrane. It actually hops from one region to the other. Okay. And because of that, when you have a myelinated axon, the speed of propagation is much higher. It could be as high as 300 miles per hour as opposed to 2 miles per hour. So can you see that there is an advantage to have neurons that can transmit information quicker? What kind of computer would you like to have? A slower one or a faster one? Well, a faster one is always better, right? So if you step out in front of a bus, you'd like to be able to see that bus is coming at you and get out of the way faster, right? So that's the advantage of myelinated axons. And that is a very, very nice advantage. All right, this kind of conduction where an action potential will skip down a myelinated fiber is what we call saltatory conduction. So the two kinds of conduction are either saltatory versus continuous. Saltatory is fast, continuous is slow. Saltatory requires myelination, and continuous doesn't require any myelination at all. Okay, now that does pose some problems for some people, unfortunately, because every once in a while, our immune systems become a little bit too active, and we call this autoimmune disease. For instance, when somebody starts to produce antibodies against their own hyaline cartilage, does anybody know what that condition is called, where your body breaks down your articular cartilage in various joints? Yeah, rheumatoid arthritis, right? So now you have bones kind of rubbing on each other, and that's an autoimmune disease. Here's another autoimmune disease when a person's own body builds antibodies that attacks the myelin, right, that these Schwann cells are building up. Actually, it's the cells of the oligodendrocytes in the central nervous system. As a result, the myelin sheath around axons in the central nervous system are degraded, and that changes the timing and function of the neurons within the brain of that person, all right, and that's called multiple sclerosis when that happens. So understanding these myelin sheaths and how they work or misbehave in people is very important because that's a fairly prevalent disease process, though it is, we're learning how to treat that pretty well. All right, we can, that's not a constant process. A person might experience an episode, an acute episode, and then it might go into remission, right? And then they'll experience another episode and then go into remission. And with treatment, those periods of remission can be extended and the severity of the acute phase can be decreased, right? You can't be cured of multiple sclerosis, but it can be controlled to some extent. And it all depends on the exact kind that a person has, right? And that has to do with the myelin sheath. Okay, let's talk about a synapse. And a synapse, I want you to know, is the structural and functional unit of communication between two cells that are touching each other. So synapse is the structure that allows cells to communicate with each other, which is very important. You know what, before I go on to synapse, I think I should stop and see if you have any points of confusion on an action potential that you can verbalize. I'm not sure you know enough about it yet to even ask a question. It's something that you have to study a little bit. But if you do have a question, okay, why don't you ask me now? Maybe you have a little stumbling block on one particular point. Yes. The frequency coding?
Yeah.
Of intensity?
Yeah. Is it also recruitment?
That's a different kind of phenomena. We'll talk about recruitment when we get to muscles and receptive fields within the nervous system.
No.
Okay.
It's not a code.
But it has nothing to do with frequency coding. Yeah. So I'll mention that later on in the class. So some of the important bullet points that I do want you to know about an action potential is what kind of membrane protein produces it. It's a voltage-gated channel. And where do you have voltage-gated channels? Only on axons, and then some axons only where within the nodes of Ranvier, right? Not underneath the Schwann cells. And because of that, axons can transmit action potentials. We call that a nerve impulse. So an axon is what we call the sending part of a neuron, opposed to the receiving part. So now we want to think about how a neuron receives information, right, from other cells. And so that means that we have to look at a synapse, because a synapse is a way for two cells to communicate with each other. How does one cell receive information from another one? And it receives information through a synapse. All right, and there are two kinds of synapses. There are chemical synapses and electrical synapses. By far the most prevalent in your body are chemical synapses, all right? And we're going to look at the structure of a synapse and compare chemical to electrical. The type of information that's transmitted between cells in an electrical synapse is actually an electrical signal. It's probably, for instance, a sodium current. But the thing that's being transmitted between cells in a chemical synapse is a chemical. And if the two cells are neurons, then we would call that a neurotransmitter. So a neurotransmitter is released by one cell and it is sensed by the other cell. The first cell in this process, on the proximal end of a synapse, we call that the presynaptic cell. And the one that's receiving the signal is the postsynaptic cell. All right, so synaptic transmission at chemical synapses is via what? Neurotransmitters. And electrical synapses are really rare in the central nervous system, but they're important in especially one organ in the body. So let's look at an electrical synapse just to get it out of the way. So here we have, what does this look like right here? Yeah, phospholipid bilayer, right? So I see one cell, and then I see another cell right underneath it, and they're kind of touching each other. But they have some special proteins within the membrane that form a channel all the way from the cytoplasm of one cell into the cytoplasm of the other. All right, so let's consider these cells at rest. What is the relative charge inside the top cell at rest? Negative. And what's the charge inside the one on the bottom at rest? It's negative. They're going to have about the same charge. But now let's issue a depolarizing stimulus to this first cell right here by opening up a sodium channel on the top cell. All right, so when sodium now can enter the cell, does it like to go into the first cell? Yeah, because it's drawn in, because the inside of the cell is negative, the concentration gradient is forcing it in. So now we have a relatively high sodium concentration inside the top cell. What about this bottom cell right here? Low sodium, still negative. So what does sodium do? Not only does it rush into the first cell, it rushes into the second cell through this structure right here, which is what we call a gap junction. So when the first cell depolarizes because sodium rushes in, what happens to the second cell? Automatically, it depolarizes as well. This is what we call an electrical synapse, right? So these proteins right here are called connexins that form this gap junction, so that if you have a whole bunch of cells, you might have a million cells all connected together with gap junctions, and if one cell depolarizes, what happens to all those millions of cells? They depolarize at the exact same time. There's one organ where that is really important, and you might be aware of this already from anatomy, and that is there's an organ that has intercalated discs. What organ is that? It's the heart, right? Because cardiac muscle has intercalated discs. It has gap junctions between the cells. So when one heart cell depolarizes, which is a stimulating event to the heart, guess what happens to the whole heart? It gets stimulated, right? And then those electrical signals causes contraction so that the heart contracts together as a unit. That's really important. Now, would you like to have these gap junctions in skeletal muscle? It seems pretty convenient. But what would happen if all your skeletal muscles were connected together with gap junctions? You would say, oh, I want to pick up this pen right here, contract your biceps brachii, and then what would happen? All the muscles in your body would contract. Well, you wouldn't have control, right? So gap junctions aren't used frequently, but in certain locations, they're very appropriate, like in cardiac muscle. All right, in most circumstances, we like to have more discrete control through a different kind of synapse that we call a chemical synapse, okay? So here is a pretty good diagram of a chemical synapse. We see the presynaptic cell, and we see the postsynaptic cell right here, and they're separated from each other by the synaptic cleft, which has interstitial fluid in it. And so this right here, you see a little swelling at the end of an axon. Sometimes we call that the terminal button, or bouton terminale, or terminal swellings. Right, it goes by a number of different names, and this area requires a lot of energy, so it's kind of swollen up because it contains a lot of organelles that make ATP, which are what? Mitochondria, for instance. So this little terminal button, right, is expanded a little bit, but it also contains vesicles right here that contain neurotransmitter. So it's loaded with vesicles as well. Okay. So what happens with this bouton terminale, as an action potential moves down an axon and it reaches the axon terminus, here are some other voltage-gated channels. These are not sodium voltage-gated channels. These are calcium. But they open up when the voltage changes, when the membrane depolarizes. All right, now where is calcium at a high concentration at rest? Outside the cell. So when these calcium channels open, calcium rushes inside the cell down their concentration gradient, and that calcium now acts as a signal. It activates something called calmodulin. All right, so it binds to calmodulin, and calmodulin then can turn a protein kinase from an inactive form to an active form. And what does a protein kinase do? Does it dephosphorylate or phosphorylate? It phosphorylates. So it starts running around the cell using ATP to phosphorylate a number of regulatory proteins that will allow these synaptic vesicles filled with neurotransmitter to dock at the membrane right here, fuse to the membrane, and then when it fuses, it exocytoses the neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. All right, so that's due to this protein kinase activity, which is due to activation of calmodulin, which is due to being activated by what? This calcium signal that comes from outside the cell due to these voltage-gated calcium channels right here. So then we have neurotransmitter, and it's going to move across the synaptic cleft because at the presynaptic membrane, the concentration is high, but at the postsynaptic membrane, the concentration is low. And how will things always move? From high to low, from high concentration at the presynaptic to low concentration at the postsynaptic membrane. And now the postsynaptic cell right here can sense the concentration of those neurotransmitters if it has something. And I'm not sure you're tracking with me, but we've talked about what those things are that can be sensitive to chemical signals. They are receptors, right? So the postsynaptic membrane has to have receptors. All right. So those receptors are proteins embedded in the membrane, and those receptors are kind of special because they're really ligand-gated channels right here. So when the neurotransmitter binds to that channel that's normally closed, right, the neurotransmitter is the ligand. It's the small molecule that binds to the channel. It opens the channel up. And in most cases, well, in some cases, we're going to see it's a sodium channel. All right, so when the neurotransmitter opens up a sodium channel, what happens to the postsynaptic cell? What does sodium like to do? It likes to go from at rest, from outside to inside. What do we call that? Is that hyperpolarization or depolarization? Depolarization. And is depolarization an excitatory or inhibitory event on the cell? It's excitatory because it brings RMP, what, closer to threshold, right? So that produces then not an action potential on this neuron, but a graded potential, right? And that graded potential flows over the dendrite, flows over the cell body, and if it's still at threshold by the time it reaches the axon hillock, what happens in the axon? Action potential, and away it goes down the axon all the way to the end. So we have ligand-gated channels on the postsynaptic membrane, right? And this signal goes from the presynaptic cell in the postsynaptic cell. It doesn't go backwards. How come it doesn't go backwards? There's two reasons. Okay. Well, what cell has neurotransmitters to secrete? Do they both have neurotransmitters? No. It's only the presynaptic cell. So the postsynaptic cell can't signal the presynaptic cell because it does not have neurotransmitters. There's another reason. All right. What receives the signal? The ligand-gated channel. And what cell does the presynaptic cell have ligand-gated channels in this region right here? Or only the postsynaptic cell? Only the postsynaptic cell. So signals really can only go in one direction for those two reasons. All right, and the amount of neurotransmitter released is directly related to the frequency of action potentials that will be instituted at the axon hillock, that will be stimulated at the axon hillock, because remember, these are graded potentials. As the potential goes higher, then that relative refractory period of an action potential can be overcome. All right, so you probably learned that calcium is very important in your body, in anatomy, and sometimes I talk about it, sometimes I don't. But what is one important function that maybe even before taking a physiology or anatomy class that you knew was an important function for calcium? Where do you need calcium? In your bones, right? Certainly in bones, to make bones strong so they don't crack. But look what you need calcium for in terms of this model right here, the chemical synapse. You need calcium in order for neurons to communicate with each other. So if you were having a choice, if you had to choose, would you rather have a brain or nervous system that's functioning properly or strong bones, if you had to make that choice? Yeah, I would give my bones away to have a brain. And I keep wishing for that to happen. But as we get older, okay, when we can't absorb as much calcium as need be, your body has to make that choice. And in order to make your nervous system function, guess where it gets calcium from? It gets calcium from your bones. And therefore, as we get older, our bones get a little bit more brittle. Okay? We can talk to me after class if you want to know how to protect yourself from that condition, which is called osteoporosis. You can't protect yourself from that from some degree. So this is probably a more important function for calcium than maintaining strong bones. So, and we call that synaptic transmissions. All right, so action potentials travel down the axon to depolarize that terminal button that opens up calcium channels, right? That calcium is driven into the cell by the electrochemical gradient. Both the electrical and the chemical gradient draws it inside the cell, and then that triggers exocytosis of vesicles releasing neurotransmitter via what? These protein kinases and calmodulin right here. That just means that this molecule can modulate the activity of this protein kinase. All right, so that's the level that you need to understand synaptic transmission at. Okay? So the neurotransmitter is really the ligand. It diffuses across the cleft, and it binds to a receptor protein on the postsynaptic membrane. All right? And it can open these chemically regulated ion channels, or what, a ligand-gated channel or a chemically regulated ion channel are exactly the same thing, which is what? A different class compared to voltage-gated channels by location and how they operate. All right, and these channels right here can actually produce two different kinds of events. All right, so I get to talk about these before we stop today. The two different kinds of events, one can be depolarizing, right? Another event can be hyperpolarizing, depending on exactly what kind of channel is opened up. So if a sodium channel opens up, sodium is going to enter the cell, the postsynaptic cell. And what's going to happen to the cell membrane as sodium enters? It's going to become more positive or less negative. What do we call that? Depolarizing, right? And that is what? An excitatory event, because you go closer to the threshold voltage, right? And so we call that an EPSP, or an excitatory postsynaptic potential, right? So postsynaptic is what cell? The postsynaptic membrane, the postsynaptic cell. All right, but on the other hand, the cell might have ligand-gated channels, which are chloride channels. What's the charge on a chloride ion?
Negative.
It's negative. Where is chloride at a high concentration? Outside the cell. It's outside the cell. So when a chloride channel opens, for instance, when a signaling molecule binds to a receptor that is a chloride channel, chloride is going to enter the cell. Now, what happens to the membrane potential as chloride enters the cell? Does it depolarize or hyperpolarize? It hyperpolarizes. And is that inhibitory or excitatory? That will inhibit, because it takes the membrane potential farther away from threshold. And when that happens, we call that an IPSP, or an inhibitory postsynaptic potential. So it all depends on what kind of ligand-gated channel it is. Sometimes it can excite the cell, or sometimes it can inhibit the cell. It all depends if it's maybe a sodium channel or a chloride channel, right? And then these are going to affect the voltage-gated channels, right, later on in the postsynaptic cell. All right, so these EPSPs and IPSPs are what we call graded potentials, all right? What are graded potentials due to? Ligand-gated channels, right? And these are found in the dendrite and neuron cell body only. And graded potentials are what? Variable in amplitude. They can change amplitude. And how do they propagate? With decrement. They fade away. Like when you hit a bell, you hit a bell and it goes ting, and then what happens to the sound intensity? It fades away. Graded potentials fade away. Right? Now, graded potentials, unlike action potentials, can add together. So if you have multiple dendrites receiving stimulation and producing graded potentials, as they flow together, right, and there's this like funnel, right, that's funneling all of this electrical activity into the axon. The axon hillock is like a funnel. All these graded potentials then can add up together, right? So negative signals or inhibitory or hyperpolarizing graded potentials can cancel out excitatory depolarizing signals. Or if they're all depolarizing signals, they can add together, they can summate to reach threshold. So we say graded potentials can summate at the axon hillock, right? And then the axon hillock makes up its own mind if it's going to institute an action potential, if it's going to start an action potential. So how does an action potential act as a little logic unit to determine whether or not an action potential is going to be initiated? Because it has, all those channels have a threshold voltage. So a neuron is pretty interesting, because it can make up its own mind whether or not it's going to transmit information or not. Okay? Skeletal muscles, on the other hand, don't work that way. If you send a signal to a skeletal muscle, what's it going to do? It's going to contract. All right? And when we get to muscle, we'll see why that is. Have you ever told your biceps to pick up a glass of water and it said no? It never does that. Skeletal muscle is really dumb. It just does what it's told to do. And that's why it's really the only voluntary organ that you have in your body. That's really the only part of your body that you can control with your consciousness. All right, so we're going to start there. If you want to work on a good figure that's in your study guide, it's that hand-drawn figure that where you have to label what part of the neuron has voltage-gated channels, what part of the neuron has ligand-gated channels, what part is ascending, which part is the receiving end. That's a really good exam figure for you to work on by next week. Okay? Yes, good question.
The figure you're talking about,
it's not in your textbook. It's just a hand-drawn figure by a previous student.
Okay.
And it's in the study guide, yeah. Yeah, if somebody has a study guide, I could hold it up. But it would take me a while to pull it up on the screen. So far, I might change my mind. Yeah.
I want to make sure this is the right thing.
Okay. Yes. Yes. Enzymes, cell respiration. Yeah. So these maybe are similar.
Well, one has more copies than the other, and I opened chapter 5.
So you got 3 chapter 5s right here. Do we know where these came from?
Yeah, off the blackboard.
Are you looking for the actual potential?
I'm not sure I know why there is a difference right here. So these two look the same.
Oh yeah, they did.
Why do I have them in 2 different places?
No. No, I think the questions were different. It said exam 2, but no, I don't know why you have it like this, because I remember it said exam 2 on the same chapter, but the questions were different.
Okay, that's a different. Yeah. So that's okay. That's a different chapter.
I did that too, and I was like, it's three different.
So, here's the figure that I would like for you to work on for the next lecture. Because here it is, blanked out. But you'll be able to label some of these things now very nicely.
I have a really good question. You know how
yeah?
we were talking about action and casual, you said it doesn't go beyond that certain amplitude. But what about when we you know how we're trying to contract our muscles?
I like these.
We're trying to contract our muscles. Aren't we trying to you know how when we're trying to do an aerobic test on a person?
Yeah.
You know, aren't we trying to stimulate that amplitude higher and higher?
What happens when you lift up something that's really light, like this pencil, as opposed to something that's really heavy? Then the concept of recruitment takes place, and when you lift up something light, only one muscle cell contracts, which is. But if you lift something heavy, you might have thousands of muscle cells contract. So that's recruitment, going from just a few muscle cells to thousands and thousands. So you can lift a lot more when it's a heavy weight if you use more of your muscle.
Okay,
so I don't know. I don't like that one. I'm going to have to see where these are in Blackboard and get rid of one of them. But I like this. Yeah, so yeah, the hand-drawn one is pretty important. It will really help you solidify. I like these. I like these. These so far, this page and this page is the same. These has different numbers right here. It doesn't have some of the figures. But these two are the same. It has the same figure numbers.
I don't know.
I'm going to have to go take a look and see. This looks like something I was working on, but not. This is the one that. Oh! I know what it is. Okay. Okay. So here is a really big file.
Yes.
And it's a lot of pages.
Yes.
Okay. Because it has all this graphic, all these graphics in here.
Yes.
Okay. So sometimes it takes a really long time to download because it's such a big file. So So what I did is I made a file that didn't contain all the graphics, but had all of this information right here, which is crucial for studying. So this you can download very quickly if, for instance, you need to get it back really fast. Or if you want to print it out, this is expensive to print out, this is cheaper to print out. That was the reason why. But now I don't know where this one came from. Yeah, I don't like the numbers. I like these two.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Yeah. So this is just a short form without figures. This has every figure. It still it tells you what figures you have to study, but it doesn't give them to you to practice. I don't like that one. Yeah, I have to go see where that one happened from. Yeah. Well, it's close. It's close.
I want to make sure if this is exactly
what you do. Okay. Oh wait, I better turn this recorder off. Thanks.